anomaly. Something that deviates from what is standard, normal or expected. An oddity, peculiarity, irregularity, inconsistency, incongruity, a rarity. I have been a nerd since long before I could have heard that bookish girls should look and act a certain way. And I'll still be a geek when I am utterly antique, because I do not care what normal people say. Hi, and welcome back to Anomaly Supplemental. This is Sue, and the bulk of today's episode is an interview I did a couple months ago with Kayla LaFrance. You probably know Kayla as the winner of Season 2 of King of the Nerds on TBS. As I said, this interview was recorded a few months ago, and it's coming out now because we've had to reschedule some things a couple of times and move some stuff around in the feed, but we're getting it out to you. We recorded this episode right after Kayla joined me on a Women at Warp episode to talk about Captain Janeway, so we had already been talking for a while about Star Trek, but then we go and talk about it again, because you can never talk enough Star Trek, but we also talk, you know, King of the Nerds, real-life science influences, growing up geek, and answer a few questions that were sent in via Facebook. But first, a couple pieces of news. Anomaly is a finalist for the Parsec Awards in the Best Speculative Fiction Fan or News General category, I believe. There are lots of categories with really long names. Those awards are given out at DragonCon in the next 2 weeks or so. As usual, I will be in attendance at DragonCon, and I hope to have my schedule up and posted on the Anomaly website later this week. Speaking of the Anomaly website, you may have noticed that there haven't been as many blogs as normal posted in the last week or so. Well, WordPress updated, and that update messed up our theme and our editing engine for those posts, so that's why there haven't been blog posts this week. But it's been reported, Jen's got a ticket in with the developer, and hopefully that will all be resolved soon, and we'll be bringing you more geeky goodness over at anomalypodcast.com. And that's all I have for you, so enjoy the interview. Kayla, thank you so much for coming on Anomaly.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Awesome. So I know a lot of our audience is going to be familiar with you from King of the Nerds Season 2, and congratulations on being our king for a year.
Thank you. I died on Mars, not very heroically.
What should people know about you if that's the only place they know you from?
Well, they did a really good job of showing who I was on the show. I'm just a very enthusiastic nerd who is deeply passionate about space exploration and Star Trek, and I also, to some people's chagrin, I say it's not so nerdy, I'm also obsessive about hockey and automotives. So, that's me in a nutshell.
I don't think that makes any sense that people say something is not nerdy. But then again, I don't think things are nerdy, I think people are nerdy. And you can be nerdy about just about anything.
I agree with that. You can be... Nerdy is more about being the extremes at which you take your passion for a certain topic. But mm-hmm. Yes, sports and cars tend to not be considered as nerdy. But you can be very nerdy about vehicles and cars and any topic. Broadway, any topic. You can be nerdy. But that's just one of those things that you put yourself out onto like something like King of the Nerds, and all of a sudden the internet feels like they can figure out any way they want to belittle you, or, you know, you didn't deserve to win, and you didn't do this, and you're not nerdy enough, and oh, whatever. So.
Well, I can tell you, I don't mean to sound pandery or anything, but I was rooting for you from episode one. Because you came on that show and you were like, I am a Star Trek fan and I am wearing my DragonCon shirt and I'm the best one. I was like, that's my girl. We're going to be good.
Yes. So disclaimer, we did meet at DragonCon. DragonCon has been my favorite con to go to. I lived in Nashville, Tennessee while I was working on my undergraduate's degree, and I have ended up getting obsessed with going to Dragon Con. It's my one trip I try to do every year. I've had to miss it time or two. I missed it the year we filmed King of the Nerds. I missed it when I was working at NASA. But yes, Dragon Con, if you're going to go to a con and truly experience what a con is all about, Dragon Con.
Yeah, I was sitting on the panel about geeky reality TV, and I look up, and there is the cast of King of the Nerds in the back row. And
so, we had all been talking about coming to Dragon Con, and we were going to meet up, and as we're looking through the program book, we all started seeing that, oh, they're going to talk about this Geeks in Reality TV. We're going to show up, because if they're going to trash our show, we're going to defend it. And we showed up waiting to, like, get in a fight, but you guys were really cool about King of the Nerds. We're like, okay, cool. We're good.
There was definitely some intimidation going on there.
Our plan worked.
So, you say that people on the internet are being people on the internet. Did you expect that? Was that, and did that, you know, have any influence on your decision to audition, I guess, for the show?
Not really. So I had tried out to be on season one, and I was offered season one, but literally the same week that I was asked to come to LA, I also received a chance to do an internship at NASA Ames. And so I quickly was like, bye. I don't care about Hollywood. I'm going to NASA. Bye-bye. And so I never watched season one. I watched the first episode, and I was a little jealous. I was like, man, I could have done that. I turned that down. I missed that opportunity. So I was very much like, I'm just not going to pay much attention to it. So I didn't know how it ended. I knew that Celeste had won, but that was the extent of it. So when they called me again, and they're like, hey, we got season two. Would you like to go through the process again and try and be on season two? I was like, sure, let's do it. Again, not having any clue about anything. And it wasn't until after everything was filmed and done and I went home, I was like, I'm going to catch up with what's what about King of the Nerds season one. That's when I realized Celeste had gone through a lot of problems online with people just, you didn't deserve to win. And for her, it was because they had done the popularity vote at the end. They didn't end with a challenge. And that got changed in season two because they saw that the fans weren't a big fan of how it was ended. And the show admitted that, you know, okay, we needed to correct that, and we did. So I was very much worried after the fact. I'm glad I didn't know going into it, because that was never anything on my mind. I was in the show, and I was doing what I needed to do to win. And I had no mindset about long-term consequences with social media and any of that thing. I completely did it for my own reasons. I was like, this is a challenge. This is something new. This is something, you know, let's do it. Let's just see what this is all about. It never was, I want to be famous and I want to do this. It was just, this sounds fun. Let's see what I can do. And so.
So by the time it all aired, you were, like, prepared for anything that might happen on social media?
I was. Curtis Armstrong was, he definitely has his hands involved with all of us from the show, and I had several conversations with him in depth about what to expect and, you know, don't let it affect you. This is, you know, this is what Celeste did, but you know, this is how it might be different for you. And every week, like, I was in L.A. during the premiere, and we, you know, sitting there at his home, we had at least one, maybe two conversations where I'm expressing my worry, and he's just like, don't worry about it, don't think about it, you'll be fine. And so, yeah, he kind of helped you through that. And then by the time it got to that point where everyone knew, you know, I had just learned to avoid Reddit. Don't go on to the King of the Nerds Facebook, and you'll be fine. Because most of the people that are going to spew idiotic, like, oh, she didn't deserve it, oh, I didn't like her, you know, name-calling and all that, they're not going to actually go and hunt you down and sit there on your Twitter and bother you. So I was just, I surrounded myself with the people that were nice, and that's how I dealt with the situation.
And it's kind of awesome that Curtis is there supporting you guys past the show, too.
Oh, very much so. He's very... He has us all over at his house during the premiere and does a big party for us. And we started calling him Papa Nerd because he does. This man loves the show. He's one of the executive producers. He is very... he wants to make sure that he's doing the right thing with the show. That the show is being a strong representation of nerd culture. And he's very passionate about it. And he cares about all of us at the show. And he's always there to... be like a father figure to any of us to, you know, you can talk to him about anything like, oh, I'm having issues with, you know, something at home. You can talk to him about that. And so he's just a very amazing man. Like that's the best takeaway is the relationship that I've grown out of my experience with him and his wife and Genevieve and some of the other contestants. It's not the $100,000 and the fact that I won. It's the fact that I have these lifelong friends now and these companions in life that have been a huge influence in the last year and a half, 2 years since I did the show.
That's really fantastic. And the show, like, when I first heard about this show, there were questions about, is this just going to be making fun of us? Mm-hmm. And when you see that someone like Curtis Armstrong is involved, you know, it takes away some of that fear. But it really does do, I think, a very good job of representing what geek culture is about right now.
You know, it was interesting because when it first came out, the announcement, this was 2011 when I'm applying. Yeah. It was October 2011. And I was so unsure that, A, it was going to be a real thing that I gave a fake social security number on my application. And B... Well, I just didn't know, like, and then B, like, there was always that constant, well, is this going to be Jeopardy-like? What is this going to be like? So I'm kind of glad I did sit out the first season and do the second season, even though I never watched the first season. But for me, once I got on set, I didn't really have, I don't want to say a lot of respect towards Curtis and Bobby, but all I thought they were, I knew they were actors. I knew where they were from Revenge of the Nerds. But that's all. I just figured they were paid faces, that they weren't they didn't know anything we were talking about, that this was just a job for them. It wasn't until maybe about a week into filming that you can see, even though they're not allowed to talk to you, you can totally see, like, Curtis especially, like, he was always just, the way he gave you eye contact and stuff, you could start to tell that, huh, this guy actually kind of cares. And it wasn't... I didn't know he was even the executive producer until during the fifth episode when we did the Star Trek Star Wars debate. My team won, and we ended up having dinner with Curtis, Bobby, and several other members of the cast of Revenge of the Nerds. And during this dinner, Curtis all of a sudden's like, I'm going to tell them a story about you. And I'm like, wait, what? And Curtis goes on to talk about how I had applied to season one, and then he talked about the moment that someone came in to talk to him and be like, we lost Kayla, because Kayla just took a job at NASA, and about how disappointed he was. And I'm like, wait, you know about all of that? And that's when I was like, oh, wait, this guy's actually involved with the show. This guy actually cares. And since then, like, it was just... this complete change of opinion for all of us about Curtis and Bobby. And then once the show aired, Curtis is like, here's my email, here's my phone number, talk to me, be in contact with me, don't just, you know, fade away into the darkness. And that's just amazing experience.
That is super awesome. Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh my gosh. You bring up the Star Wars Star Trek episode. Oh,
God, I hate that episode.
I know. Wait, I didn't, you know, write this down, but you were very adamant on the show about hating that debate. Mm-hmm. And I'm right there with you, because I think, you know, these are apples, oranges.
Well, see, I don't like the debate because I lost, and I feel like I failed. And so I don't like that at all. And, like, Katie and I loved the debate and the fact that we were having fun. Like, Kate, there was one point, you don't see it, our debate went a lot longer than you see, which is one of the things that bothers me.
Oh, sure, yeah.
How many emails I got afterwards going, why didn't you say A, B, C, D? And, like, I said all that, you just don't see it all. Trust me. I brought it up. I just don't like it because I lost. And that was one of the few times that me as an individual failed to actually, you know, perform the way I wish I could have. And so, and going into it, I've always hated the debate format. So I was already nervous. Like, this is Star Trek. I have to uphold perfection because this is Star Trek. You know, I gotta be 7 of 9 here. I have, this is the Omega Directive. I gotta be perfect. I gotta see perfection. And, I failed. And I've hated myself. And, yeah, that was, again, one of those moments where you realize Curtis cares a lot more than just being an actor, because he, at the end of the dinner, he gave me a hug, and he was like, you did really good today, and I was like, I don't feel that way, and he's like, stop doing that to yourself. So, but, yeah, I hated that debate. Enterprise would have won. They would have just beaten the dang thing up! Oh my gosh. If you're gonna have a Star Wars actor, you gotta have a Star Trek actor too. I'm sorry, it was not,
well, that's true.
It was misrepresented.
Besides the fact that you can't even compare the thing that happened a long, long time ago and the thing that is happening 400 years in the future.
Yeah.
But
that too.
So I think I have just like one more King of the Nerds question, okay, for you, and then which is, until season 3, this season, both winners were women.
Woohoo! Yes.
So, what do you think that is saying about geek culture and nerd culture right now? That the first 2 seasons, you had 2 women taking home the prize.
I guess it just shows that women, the whole fake geek girl stuff is kind of BS. And that women know their stuff just as well as guys do, and we can have the same level of passion and get involved to the same level as any man. And, you know, some of those, look at Nerdio Kart. I wiped the floor with those boys. Aren't boys supposed to be better at car-related stuff than girls? Come on. Like, it was a matter of shattering stereotypes and just showing that, you know, stereotypes, while they are based on some truth, they don't cover the whole truth. And that was mostly how I just saw it, is that women are here to stay, and you're not going to get rid of us, and we can dominate and control when we need to, and we certainly did for several years there.
So there. So I want to ask you a little bit more about stuff for you.
Okay.
We just recorded a Women at Warp episode.
Yes.
So you and I have talked a little bit about this, but not in the Anomaly nutshell, I guess. But Trek was my first love in fandom. Mm-hmm. And I know that you're a huge Star Trek fan. You're a big Voyager fan.
Yes.
And how do you feel about the hate that Voyager gets, especially Janeway?
You know, I grew up watching Star Trek. My family, my parents don't get Star Trek. It annoyed them. It just drives my parents crazy because they don't like the show at all, and they don't see how I got so into it. It's probably why, because I didn't like it. But when Voyager came out, there was a woman in charge. There was some great, strong females, you know, a Klingon female and everything, and I love the show. And as I'm hearing people like, oh, Voyager's the worst show, and oh, Janeway's the worst captain, I really don't take it personally, and for the most part, I just roll my eye and, like, whatever, you can like what you, you know, like what you want, because personally, I can't stand Deep Space Nine. I think it is a horrible Star Trek, you know, but I know people are passionate that that's the best Star Trek out there, so I honestly tend to just be like, okay, whatever, you can believe what you want to believe, I'm going to believe what I want to believe. And it does come down to personal preference and opinion. A lot of the guys that do give Janeway crap, it comes down to them not wanting to acknowledge or accept a change in society where women are going to be on even footing. You know, they might not even know that what they're saying is sexist, but it comes from being born and raised in a male-dominated society, and I don't even think half the time they realize what they're saying. So, I just, for the most part, I just chalk it off and walk away. Whatever. Whatever.
Yeah, I totally get that. I mean, DS9 is a totally different kind of Star Trek. It's a totally different kind of story.
Yeah.
So they're going to be different, and the shows are so different that I think they are going to attract different people.
They do, and it's funny because one of my best friends is all about Deep Space Nine, and I'm all about Voyager, and we, in very joking way, we all constantly are giving each other crap about it. And the things that I hate the most about Deep Space Nine are the things that she likes the most, and the things that I like the most about Voyager are the things that she can't stand. A lot of the people that don't like Voyager are like, it was too science-y, it was too techno-babble. That's what I love the most. I'm a scientist. I'm an engineer. I want that. I don't give one iota about the Bajoran religion. I was so sick of hearing about the prophets and the orbs and the aliens and the wormhole and the emissary. I was like, this is Star Trek. Get rid of the bloody religion. And there was no exploration at all. It just was, we were stuck on a space station with the whole religion thing going on, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's a war. You had the entire Gamma Quadrant. You could have showed us all new stuff. Where with Voyager, it was always new. Almost every alien was a new alien because it wasn't what we had seen on Next Generation. Because it was in a new area of the universe, the galaxy. And so, again, it's the things that most people don't like about that show are what drew me to it the most.
Yeah, I love the science on Voyager, especially mm-hmm. when you get Janeway and Torres working together, and then later adding Seven into that.
Yes.
Because you've got these women who are supporting each other, and they're all scientists, and they're all working together towards an end goal.
Mm.
And I think in a professional setting, even sometimes in a social setting, women are almost conditioned to tear each other down.
Yeah.
it's everything is supposed to be a competition, and that's not what you see in Voyager at all. They're all trying to help each other,
mm-hmm.
and no one's saying, you're wrong, my idea's better. They're saying, oh, what if we take that and add this to it,
mm-hmm.
and that'll help us fix it. And that's something you don't get on other Star Trek. Even when there are multiple women on the crew, mm-hmm. like Crusher and Troi, they're not working together to solve a problem, where they should be, because they're the medical doctor and the psychiatrist, essentially.
Yes.
But they're very rarely ever discussing a medical condition together.
Yeah.
Whereas on the Voyager, you have three women who are fixing the ship every other episode.
Yes. And, I mean, I know a lot of people are fans of the Crusher and Troi, and I know I get myself in trouble when I say this, but I don't feel like when I was a kid, or even now, today, as a 30-year-old, watching The Next Generation, I have no connection at all to the women characters. There's nothing about the women characters I care about. I'm more interested in Data. I'm more interested in LaForge. Guinan might be the one exception, but she's such a irregular character, you don't have that big connection. Deep Space Nine was a little different. I did, you did have Jadzia Dax, who was this strong female character, who was science, but she didn't, I don't feel like her character was often acknowledged in the role that it could have been. I think she still had, you've had that male aspect to it, with her being the symbiont, with Dax and stuff, and when Sisko talked to her, it always seemed more like he was connecting to the male side of the previous lives than he was to Jadzia, just a female on the same level. And so it wasn't until Voyager came along that I was like, these are women characters that I liked. Kes kind of drove me crazy. I didn't, as a female, watching a female, I didn't get into her like I did B'Elanna, like I did Janeway. Seven of Nine, I just had to roll my eye at the whole sex symbol aspect of her and just ignore that and look at the fact that that girl had a brain, and boy, does she know how to use it.
It's interesting, your point about Jadzia. They definitely went the way of making her one of the boys,
mm-hmm.
kind of in more ways than one. I've been watching a lot of Ferengi episodes lately, and there is a lot of times where she excuses their, like, blatant sexism and misogyny while she's playing Dabo or whatever down at Quark's bar. And it's interesting because it's just an interesting choice for the character. And then to almost completely 180 and make all of your really strong scientists on the next series are all women. Not to say that Troy and Crusher necessarily aren't, because technically they are scientists, but they're still in these nurturing roles, in these caretaking roles.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, when you... I just can't ever think about, like, with Troy, again, I'm not your typical girl to begin with, because I am more the tomboy. I play hockey, I work on cars. I was the first girl to play football at my junior high. Like, I've always been more in the male world to begin with. And so to sit there and see him talking about their love encounters, I'm like, I want to die. I don't care. Move on. This is Star Trek. I don't want erotica. I know it invented slash fiction, but I don't want it. And so, like, when you do look at the Crusher, like, the one Crusher episode I like was when she was actually being an investigator scientist. Oh, what was the name of the one?
Yeah, Suspicions.
Yes, yes. And she's trying to figure out who killed who. You know, it was almost like a Clue of Star Trek. And with Troy, I kind of like the episode where she's finally realizing, oh, maybe I need to actually learn how to be a real Starfleet officer and learn how to command the bridge. But I still felt like she got a little whiny. That was the one thing with Troy. Mm-hmm. I always felt like she was whiny. I was like, oh, gosh, can you just grow a set of balls and grow up and shut up and just take it, you know? But instead, she would always come across to me as whiny and upset about things. And I'm like, okay, moving on. So, yeah.
Well, I think we get to Voyager and they start breaking down finally, maybe mm-hmm. even starting with Jadzia on DS9, the difference between, you know, what is expected of these male characters and what is expected of these female characters. And mm-hmm. maybe there shouldn't be a distinction anymore, because there definitely shouldn't.
Yeah, it definitely started in Deep Space Nine. You have to give them credit for both Kira and mm-hmm. Jadzia. They're both strong female characters and stuff. Kira, I love the fact that she was that hard-to-the-nose leader, but she was a military leader. She doesn't have that science aspect. And with Jadzia, she was the scientist, but she really didn't have the leader aspect. And that's why Janeway ended up being, like, the culmination of both of those for me. It was the leader who was getting the respect, but she was also the mind that was getting the respect, not the hoochie mama with a body, and that's why we're going to respect her. She was just one of the guys. She was respected as a female, and, you know, it was like the perfect combination of all of the previous female characters.
So I know Janeway's up there, but outside of Star Trek, fictional or non, who would you say were the people that were inspirations for you growing up and even, like, entering higher education and deciding on a career path, even?
Well, my biggest mentor was my 7th grade science teacher. He was the one that was like, you know way too much about Star Trek and have no clue about what's real and what's not real. And so he was the one who was like, why don't you pick up a book about NASA? Why don't you start reading about what our real capabilities were? Because you don't really, like, you know that there really aren't Klingons running around out there, but I remember being, you know, it's almost embarrassing to say now, but I remember being in the 6th grade, and I'm looking at a photo from the Viking mission on Mars, and everyone's like, we've never been to Mars, and I'm sitting there going, but why do we got photos from Mars then? Like, I never figured out, oh, because we put a camera there, not a human. Like, it confused me at first. We'd been to the moon, and all the photos that we have of the moon are from astronauts being on the moon. So how do we have a photo on Mars? And yeah, it was that science teacher Thomas Herman, who was just like, no, here. Star Trek's awesome. I like it too. But let's look at what's real. And he's the one that really kind of changed my life into, I like space. This is a fun show. Oh my God, I want to go into space. But real characters that were like role models. See, this is where I don't really have, other than Janeway, there are no females on my list. Jean Kranz was the flight director for the Apollo missions. He started during the Mercury program. I've idolized him for years. I want to work mission control. What he did with Christopher Kratt to build mission control, I've always just, that he's one of my biggest mentors, or heroes, inspirations. And also Von Braun, Dr. Von Braun, who basically single-handedly created the entire line of rockets that got us to the moon. Like, those are the kind of people that really had the inspiration for me. Those were the people that I would look at and read their autobiographies. I have a lot of respect for Eileen Collins, the first female commander who was a shuttle pilot. Amelia Earhart, one of the first females that really, you know, made it possible for us today to go get a pilot's license and such. But I never had the same, maybe it's just because it's not my interest. Now, if there has been a female mission controller during the Apollo age, then maybe they would take the rank instead of Jean Kranz. But I guess part of it is because there just has not been a lot of strong historical women in the roles that I most want to be involved with in my life.
I remember first learning about Jean Kranz from Apollo 13, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say I was probably 6th or 7th grade at that point. And that movie made me fall in love with mission control.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents even sent me to space camp.
Yes.
After that. I left the hard sciences because I wasn't that great with physics, so that's when I stuck with math. But seeing those people do that sort of thing, even when it's sort of fictionalized, it makes you want to go back and learn what really happened.
Yes. Oh, and
there's just so much great history that comes out of Mission Control that it's fantastic.
Yeah, and because for me it was a little opposite. Like, I decided I liked Mission Control when I went to space camp. Like, okay, it was fun getting to do the shuttle simulator. It was fun getting to do the space station simulator and getting duct taped to the floor and, you know, all of that stuff. But when I was in Mission Control, that's when I was like, this is cool. This is fun. I like this stuff. And then, you know...
Were you flight director?
I was flight director... I'm trying to think. I've gone so many times, I gotta remember which one was which. I was flight director when I was at the U.S. Space Camp. I did the Advanced Space Academy. I was 14. And then when I was 15 and 16, I went to the Future Astronaut Training Program, and I was always Capcom during those two, because flight director was always the, the counselor in charge. So I was always Capcom, which would be technically, in that way, second in charge.
Yeah, I technically went to Space Academy as well. And I was mission specialist on one and flight director on the other.
I was commander. I was always a shuttle commander. I was the kid that at space camp at age 14, it was summer 99. Oh, October 99, actually. I could tell you exactly which Voyager episode I missed, because it was the only episode I didn't watch live because my parents didn't record it either. I was so mad. Barge of the Dead, by the way.
This is my favorite.
Barge of the Dead. I was the kid that literally, we walk into the shuttle simulator for the first time, and I already knew where every button was. Because I had already been studying the manual from NASA, and I already knew all of the acronyms. And my name at space camp, everyone called me Spock. Oh, you mean the know-it-all Spock? Yeah, Spock over there. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm all right with that.
That's amazing.
So I went on to do my thesis about mission control in college. Like, I've studied mission control because of just that love affair with, you know. And I've studied all the transcripts from Apollo 13 and everything that had happened. And the psychology. There's a lot of psychology involved with doing mission control. And how do you... The us versus them syndrome that occurs when you're dealing with missions like this. You have the people on the ground who don't, you know, the people in space are like, you don't have a clue what we're dealing with right now. And the people on the ground are like, but we're in charge, listen to us. And there's a lot of psychology, and there's been several interesting occurrences where we've had what has been considered a mutiny in space. We had a crew during the Skylab mission. It was the third manned Skylab mission. They basically turned off their communication system, like, screw you, we're not talking to you for the next 24 hours. None of those astronauts flew again when they came back. you know, so there's been a lot of that stuff, and that's what I fascinates me. That's the focus of space that I want to get involved with.
So is your goal right now to get in and get into mission control, or do you want to work on the spacecraft itself, or what's the next step?
For me, I want to do operations. Going into college, I told my grandfather that I was going to build the cars for Mars and be the one to drive them. I wanted to build the manned rovers for Mars missions. But as I started going through college, I love science and I love engineering. And I'm one of those people that's like, I love both of those. I'm really good at both. But I also have this strong like for I don't want to say political side of it, but the public side of things and dealing with people. And so I quickly had some advisors and people in college be like, then you need to go into operations, because operations are the people that are in the middle of, here are the businessmen, here are the individuals who are basically selected by the Congress to run NASA. They don't usually have the slightest clue how to even spell space, not alone what we're doing in space. And then you've got all the engineers and all the scientists down here who have to do the work. And trying to get those two to talk to each other and understand each other in between are usually the operations people. And so that's where I want to find myself, is in a role where I get to basically translate the politics to the engineer, but translate the engineer to the politics. And that's where Mission Control really comes in, because in Mission Control, that's where you're putting mission objectives together, but you're also having to put the science and technical side of how the spacecraft works together. And all that has to work together flawlessly for a mission to work. And so I am trying to get into NASA Mission Control. I've gotten as far as assessment. I haven't received a job in Mission Control yet. I probably have like 8 applications right now to work at various unmanned mission controls out there, and it's just a matter of being hired. It's been a couple years, though, so I'm starting to go like, when does my college degree expire and I have to go back to school so it's considered relevant? it's not the easiest thing to get into. I'm currently working on some new papers to try and get published, just so it looks like I'm fresh. But, yeah.
Being that go-between is such an important thing, I think, especially right now, because the public hasn't really been excited about space in a really long time.
I think the last time that we really saw that kind of interest in the public was actually Curiosity. NASA actually has some very interesting rules they have to follow about how they do public outreach, because they're a government agency, and so there are strict rules of how they're allowed to do, how much money they put towards it. And, like, the military is really the only exception. Like, they're the only ones that can put a lot of money into recruiting. And all the other government agencies can only do very minimum level public outreach. So, like, if the CIA and FBI could do the same amount of advertising as the military could, you know, we might have a different view of them. And that's the same with NASA. So NASA relies a lot on public service announcement laws and on universities. You know, they'll bring in a university to work on a mission, and they have to pretty much rely on that university to advertise that, oh, we're doing this mission with NASA, and that's how NASA gets their advertisement. So you don't get to see a lot of it until all of a sudden that there's something that just piques the interest of the public. And I think Curiosity was the latest moment of that, because the whole 7 Minute of Terror, it was a public service announcement video that NASA made, and it went viral. And it was just talking about the complexity of the crane system they were using and how we don't know what happens until like an hour later or 7 minutes later because of the distance. And that really seemed like the public was interested in that.
Yeah, and those guys became internet celebrities at the very least for a little while anyway. But what do you think, since I know you're on top of it, what do you think is the most important thing that people should know about that's going on right now for NASA and space exploration?
This is The hard part, right now what just happened was the new budgets came out for the next couple of years, and well, particularly the next year. But anytime you're budgeted for 1 year, you kind of have an idea of what your maybe 2 years after that will also look like. And so in this newest budget, they cut how much money we have for commercial crew, and they're increasing the money that we're putting on the SLS, which is supposed to be the new rocket that we're building. And this is good, but this is also bad. It's good because we need to get our own rocket up, and I think the fact that the Russians have failed to launch a rocket successfully twice in a row in the last 2 years is really scaring NASA. So far, the Russians haven't lost a rocket with a crew on it, but they've had 4 failures in the last year and a half, which is not a good record. And so that's who we have to rely on to get our crew into space. And so we do need to get the SLS up there. We need to get it built. We need to get that system going. But by cutting commercial crew is where we fund places like SpaceX, Boeing, Lockheed Martin. It's where government is giving these companies money to build their own commercial systems that the government will ultimately use. And so by cutting that back, we might not see SpaceX grow as fast as they have been growing. We're not going to see some of these other private companies that are trying to get themselves out there have as much funding to continue going, which it's a give and a take. And so NASA needs more funding is what it comes down to.
Well, that's something that I feel like has been the case for a long time. It just keeps... Mm-hmm. It keeps getting harder, it seems.
Yes.
Which is unfortunate.
Well, it's a brutal cycle because, if the people don't care, you're not going to get funding, but the people don't care because you're not getting funding because you're not doing anything. And it's like a vicious cycle that they kind of work with each other and against each other and, everyone was all into it, but then once we landed on the moon, they stopped caring. Oh, we won. Who cares? And then it just fell off the wayside, and the more people don't seem to care, the more people don't care if they're funded. And the big thing that people should consider is NASA isn't just space exploration. First of all, NASA is funding places like SpaceX to do what they're doing, and what they're doing is great. Creating the taxi for space is really a huge help for us. But NASA also creates technologies that you would never even imagine, because they're involved in science, all form of research. And your airbag, let's take this. Everyone has known at least one person who has had an airbag maybe save their life or deploy on them during a crash. Airbags rely on us, and we're going to ignore GM and their massive airbag recall right now. The airbags rely on an accelerometer to ignite and to pop open. So basically, an accelerometer can tell sudden movement occurs. And when that sudden movement occurs at a certain amount of G-forces, it ignites the bag. It explosively opens the bag. The accelerometer was created for a spacecraft. How do you tell what way is up or down, or which way your spacecraft is oriented in zero gravity? How do you know when it's moving a certain direction? You use accelerometers because they're able to tell where there's movement and in which direction that movement is. So if we never had made spacecraft and never had to figure out how to make orientation movements of spacecraft in space, we might not have airbags today. And that's the big thing that I think a lot of people who don't follow NASA don't understand. There's always the jokes about Tang, but actually Tang was invented before NASA was. That's just a joke. That's but Teflon was created by NASA. Velcro is another fun one that gets brought up a lot. But almost the entire outfit of a firefighter right now has components made by the space industry. Fiery retardant clothing and tiny nozzles that allow them to have the multiple airbags, or not airbags, air tanks, and all of that. NASA helped create the valve, that there's one key valve in the artificial heart, and it had to be this certain tiny small valve, and that is one of those things that came out of NASA researching how to make something work in a spacecraft. And that correlation and those spin-off technologies, that's what, if I could have funding to do like a massive nationwide NASA PSA, like, the more you know, the more you're going to love NASA, that's what I'd focus on, is how much daily, everyday things in your life would you not have because of NASA?
Well, and the first thing you mentioned, accelerometers, they're everywhere now.
Oh, yeah, they're in your phone, your iPhones.
They're in your phone. They're the reason you have Fitbit, you know, all of your fitness trackers. They're everywhere.
Yeah. I know NASA does something similar with that with racing. There's one race every year that they will team up with. I think it's maybe it's Pepsi or something. And they get a deck one of the cars out in NASA gear. And they have little, like, during the race, this is like a NASCAR race. And during the race, they'll, like, you know, this feature on the car was actually created for this NASA mission. And, like, so it's, they test it with that. But I think you're dealing with a market that already doesn't care about technology. They just want to see things crash. Which I don't think helps NASA, because then they're just going to want to watch NASA go boom. But, yeah, it's.
I could talk about this stuff with you forever, but I've already taken up another, like, 45 minutes or so of your time.
Oh, we're fine.
There are a couple questions that came in on Facebook.
Okay.
And I'll just get to those.
Okay.
The first one, Jeffrey asked, referencing, again, King of the Nerds, about your take on the reboots, the JJ-verse.
I absolutely despise the reboots. Jar Jar Abrams. So
we don't have to go into it. We can leave it there if you want.
Well, no, like, I was willing to give it a shot. I went into it with a very open mind, and Star Trek 09 was not too bad. I'm willing to go with it. I was willing to go with it. Into Darkness was a big old slap in your face that made me just, I don't want to ever deal with any of this. You know, you don't put a spaceship under the ocean. For that matter, you can't build a spaceship like that even on the plains in Ohio, but I was willing to go with it. But then, in the ocean, it was too much. Like, that the tiny little
you
net...
You can't have structural integrity in both space and underwater. You just
exactly,
can't.
Exactly! You can't! And...
I'm so glad that your problems with that are my problems with that.
My whole problem is not the whole new world. It's not any of that. It's the fact that what the hell is red matter? What? How do you get, like, 1 minute they're at the orbit of, like, the moon, and then they say, first of all, they say, like, the wrong distance between the Earth and the moon, and then they're magically on the surface of San Francisco faster than light would have traveled. Like, they had zero respect for anything science. And that is what got to me. That is what scares me when you hear Peg say, oh, they're taking the Trek out of Star Trek. It's like, oh, God. It's like, I love Star Trek because when they talk about the Dyson Sphere and Next Generation, the Dyson Sphere... Dyson, the man, he was a real man who really created the Dyson Sphere of theory. This was real stuff. Like, and then to just see it be like, oh, we don't care, and oh, let's just magically not need to ever have a spacecraft again because we can just warp from Kronos to Earth. Or not warp, transport from Kronos to Earth. What? Oh! So... And, like, okay, the transporter already is one of those wave-your-hands magical science moments. But then to push it that far, and that's really what bothers me. It's not the fact that we had to have a do-over. I was okay with that. It was just the fact that the things that I love about Star Trek were not incorporated. And if anything, they were more poo-pooed on. And, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you on pretty much all of that. And I'm not a huge fan of the reboots myself, but I find their redeeming quality in if they bring more people into Star Trek who then go back and watch TOS, TNG, DS9, Voyager, that bring them into the fandom as a whole, then I'm okay with them existing, but I don't want too much to do with them myself.
And I fear that that's not going to work, because if you're bringing in fans by making these blockbuster movies that have no science in them, they're not going to be the same fans that are going to like sitting down watching an arcing story plot about science. They're not going to take it seriously. And I don't think they'll be fans of Trek as in the new stuff, but I don't think they would go and fall in love with the old Trek. And honestly, I love Star Trek, but stop with the movies already. Star Trek has never been a good movie maker. It's like DC and Marvel. Marvel, go make your movies, I don't care. DC, please stick to the TV shows. You make great TV shows, bad movies.
Star Trek belongs on TV.
It does.
It's absolutely true.
It does, and oh my gosh, they have awesome opportunity to start something new for the 50th anniversary. Paramount, are you listening?
Yeah. Probably not to us.
No. No.
All right. Next Facebook question was, from Pierre, what is your favorite video game of all time?
Oh gosh. Did this person watch King of the Nerd at all? Damn Pac-Man. I'm not a big video gamer. I've never really gotten into video gaming. I am a big fan of the Arkham games because I'm a huge Batman fan. I bought a PlayStation 3 so I could get the first Arkham, Arkham Asylum. I bought a new TV so I would be ready for Arkham City. And I have pre-ordered the Batman Edition PS4 so I could have Arkham Knights. So I do really enjoy the Arkham games. I play Portal. I play anything with the car, Gran Turismo and Burnout. But if I have an hour of free time, if that ever happens, I tend to watch Star Trek and not play video games. I play DCU Online. Maybe I would have been a bigger gamer if there had been better Star Trek games. Do you remember Star Trek Borg and how annoying that game got? Ugh.
The last one I remember playing was on the Sega Game Gear.
Oh, jeez.
Well, and you, like, encountered a Ferengi ship that was, like, a little reddish-brown dot, and you had to blow it up.
There was this one game, it was called Star Trek Borg, and it was, like, a video movie game. Like, you had to click a certain, like, you'd either click the hypospray or click the phaser, and it was Delancey. And I was like, what's the point? I'm just not a big video gamer. The running joke with fans of the show is just the fact that I couldn't get past level 1 of Pac-Man, which is funny because ever since I was a little girl, my mom was a big Pac-Man fan, loves Pac-Man, could play Pac-Man and miss Pac-Man, and so we had a mini arcade game of Pac-Man, and I don't think I have ever got past level 1. I've always hated that game. I've never done well with it. So when I'm sitting there in the final challenge and I see Pac-Man, I'm just like, crap. Of all the games, why Pac-Man?
So last one from Christy. She asks, what planet-like body or moon would you be most interested in exploring?
Mars.
Not just because it's probably the next thing we'd go to, definitely Mars, no matter what.
Mars has just been kind of my focus, my focal point for years. It's just been where I've wanted to go. If I was given the USS Voyager right now and I could go to one place anywhere in the solar system or the galaxy, I want to go to M42. That's a nebula in the constellation of Orion. Everyone knows it as the Great Orion Nebula. I just want to know what it would be like to go towards that thing. Because this thing, it's a little over 1,400 light years away. And it's already pretty big. You can see it with naked eye in the right conditions. What would it be like to be 1,000 light years from that? What would it look like to be 100 light years from that? knowing that this thing is thousands of light years across. And to me, I just want to, I want to explore something that gives me the sense. I understand the magnitude of space, but I want to sense it. I want to truly fathom that. And so for me, I've always wanted to go straight towards that nebula. That nebula has, you know, you can, if you study it enough, if you see it through enough telescopes, you see the three-dimensional shape to it. You know that the trapezium tends to stick up in front, and the rest of it has these prevailing solar winds that have pushed kind of this dome shape around it. And it's like, what would it be like to go and fly through that? And just, that's the true biggest thing I would want to do, if I could do anything, would be to see the magnitude of space firsthand and the sheer volume and size. Because even in Star Trek, you never get that sense. They're always, that's one of the things when you start learning about orbital mechanics and they start saying how far away they are from things and you look at it on the view screen, you're like, so is your view screen satellite another 100,000 light years that way or what? Because, you know, the proportions, we can't fathom them. But planet-wise, it has to be Mars, just because I've been so connected to it. But I wouldn't turn down anywhere. Europa, Enceladus, Titan, I don't care. I will go. Let's go. Anywhere. Let's go.
I think that is the perfect thing to wrap up on, because it's really true. I love it. Where can people find you? What are your projects online? I know you're doing some Knights of Nerdvana stuff.
Yes. So I started a little website called the Knights of Nerdvana. It kind of started out of the fact that we weren't sure if we're going to have a season 3 last year. And so I got together with a whole bunch of really passionate fans of King the Nerds, and we created the Nerd Army, and we kind of did this online campaign to flood TBS with "we want season 3" kind of things. And after we got season 3, we're like, well, let's just keep doing this. And it became the Knights of Nerdvana. And it's just, we try to make it a safe haven for people who want to just hang out with other nerds, other people that like different Star Trek, Star Wars, anime, fantasy, whatever it is. We do roundtable challenges every month where we challenge ourselves to learn about a form of the nerd culture that we might not know. Like, I watched Attack on Titan for one of the challenges. It's like, not my forte, but it was interesting to see something new. So that's theknightsofnerdvana.com. We have weekly podcasts. We host people who want to get into podcasting. So if you want to start your own podcast, get a hold of us and we'll give you a platform to see if you want to do it full time. And we've had two podcasts now that started with us. They got going, they built up, and then they went on to their own place once they got the mechanism down. And you can find me on Twitter at @OntoMarsKayla or @OntoMars_Kayla. And I also have a fan page on Facebook, and I try and interact with anyone that sends me a message, so go ahead and shoot me a message.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming and talking about just about everything, and for basically giving me, 3 hours of your day on a Saturday.
Well, thanks for having me. I mean, it was fun to talk. I could talk about Janeway all the time, and of course, space, naturally. I could always talk about that, so thanks for having me on and giving me the chance.
All the cool kids keep enthusiasm rationed, right down to the last explosive ounce. But I'd rather indulge my many passions, even if my squaritude's a little too pronounced. Perhaps I do not strike you as a geek.
If you wish to contact the Anomaly Supplemental, you can at the email address, which is moregirlygeeks@gmail.com. That's girlygeeks with a Z supplemental@gmail.com. Or if you like hearing the sound of your own voice, like I do, you can call the voicemail line at 248-419-GEEK. Yes, it's one of those numbers that you can use alphabets on, and that's 248-419-4335. To stay up to date with Anomaly and Anomaly Supplemental News, you can follow them on Twitter at Anomaly Podcast. That's the at symbol, A-N-O-M-A-L-Y podcast. Check out the Anomaly blog for geeky articles and Anomaly supplemental show notes. Find it online at anomalypodcast.com. That's A-N-O-M-A-L-Y podcast.com. Theme music is used by permission of Marion Call. Thank you, Marion. Find out more at mariancall.com. Or, of course, you can follow her on Twitter at Marion Call. That's MarianCall. Anomaly was created under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 Unported License. Say that three times fast.
World is much too interesting to entertain ennui, and I won't ever play it cool, so I won't ever once be bored. Oh,
I have been a nerd since long before anyone heard that fair and scrawny was the latest fashion trend. And I still be a geek after nobody thinks it's chic, because I don't.